That's how we start. Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of San Francisco. My name is James Taylor. I am your moderator. And we are happy tonight to have Paulette Brown with us. She is the president of the American Bar Association. And our topic is making the justice system just. So that will be a really interesting topic for tonight. Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club, the place where you're in the know. We are online at thecommonwealthclub.org, on Facebook, on Twitter, and check out your YouTube channel. I'm James Taylor, Director of African American Studies and Professor of Political Science at the University of San Francisco and Lecturer of African American Studies and Diaspora Studies in the Department of African American Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. And I'm your moderator for today's program. A minute of introduction to Paulette Brown. Paulette Brown's venerable legal experience ranges from being a municipal court judge to serving on the Commission on Women in the Profession. She has repeatedly been named as New Jersey's super lawyer and by U.S. News as one of the best lawyers in America for commercial litigation. Ms. Brown has been recognized by the National Law Journal as one of the 50 most influential minority lawyers in America. Ms. Brown grew up attending segregated schools in Baltimore, went on to Howard University to get a law degree from Seton Hall University. After serving in its House of Delegates, the Board of Governors, and its Executive Committee, Paulette Brown is one of a handful of women to lead the American Bar Association as president and the first woman of color to do so. She has devoted her presidency to, quote, rebuilding the nation's confidence in our justice system by working to eliminate bias and enhance diversity and inclusion. She says her own biases are for thin people and for people who are gay. So she should be really happy here in San Francisco. Welcome to San Francisco.
That's not exactly right.
This is Paulette Brown. Let's give her a round of applause and welcome her. So, Ms. Brown, when I was looking at your pictures, when I got all of the information, I kept looking for your battle scars, trying to figure out how do you come, rise from being a young girl in Baltimore, in the time period, and then to rise up to the level where you have professionally throughout your career, throughout your education and your career, to where you are now at the pinnacle, I would assume, on some level, of being recognized by your peers, and to get 550 lawyers to agree on one thing is amazing, and their unanimous support for you as president. And that just obviously speaks volumes to how lawyers at every level in this country have respect for you. So I'm just wondering, how do we get from the young girl in Baltimore to the woman you are now?
I'll just say I'm stubborn, hard-headed. It has been a journey for me, as you can imagine, not always simple, but I had some real basic training at home through my parents, mm-hmm. And learned that no, that you can't do something is not acceptable, and that you always do the best that you can do. And really, the biggest thing was that no, don't ever allow anybody to tell you what is you cannot do. Mm-hmm. So, that sort of stayed with me. And I have to say that it was reinforced at Howard in a big way. And that it really helped me to get through law school, which I found very different and very challenging. And just such a paucity of people of color. And even at that time, there were only African Americans and whites, and only 8 of us African Americans. There were no Hispanics, there were no Asians in law school with me, none of that.
And just two women, is that correct, out of the 200 students?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, but it was, you just keep moving forward, knowing that, you have some challenges that sometimes you can overcome them quicker than you'd like, and other times not, mm-hmm. but you just keep going.
Who are the people you think of fondly at Howard when you think of people who influenced you at Howard?
So there are, well, I will tell you, my English teacher, my freshman English teacher, was a big influence because I thought I was a great writer. And
which all the law students and lawyers are like, that's great, right? Because they know.
So this was an undergraduate school. And when I got my first essay back, she wrote on it that it was sophomoric. I'm like, Are you kidding me? So I went back and talked to her. That never, ever happened again. And my son proclaims that I really should have been an English teacher. But, you know, but a lot of it had to do with my peers and other students who were very self-directed and knew exactly what they wanted to do. And so when you have people who know that and who are wanting to lead, you know, I think that people always rise to expectations and they lower themselves to expectations, and expectations are always very high.
So let me ask you this. In terms of your tenure as ABA president, what have you learned about the profession of law as you've gone about this year around the profession that you might not have appreciated beforehand? Is there anything that you, any eye-opening experiences you've had in this year?
So I have had an opportunity to visit all 50 states at least once, the District of Columbia, and two territories. And this is my 19th visit to California since I've been president. And the one thing that I've learned, no matter where I am, that people are concerned about access to justice, no matter where, South Dakota, Montana, everywhere. I thought that where there would be a more diversity in some locations in the Northeast, almost zero, and yet there was more diversity in Idaho, for example, than there was in Maine.
Wow.
So, you know, I found that a bit surprising. And what I found really interested in were the states that were interested in knowing more about diversity and inclusion. It would have never occurred to me that the Chief Justice in South Dakota would require all of its judges to come and listen to me and watch a video about implicit bias for judges. So that was a very pleasant surprise for me.
So after this journey, this year-long tenure, are you more or less discouraged? Are you more encouraged or discouraged?
I am encouraged within the legal profession about the mindset of so many people and the willingness to accept the fact that all of us have some implicit biases. And by the way, I only slightly favored thinner people.
That's right.
and that they're receptive to knowing more, and that they're really only a very small percentage who continue to question and really want me to force me to say that something is somebody's fault. But there is generally overall a receptiveness to being more inclusive by lawyers. Sometimes not all lawyers, and there's a certain group of people that's still resistant. I will tell you, unfortunately, guys, okay, I hate to say it, I know it's nobody in this room, but generally white males over 60 are still resistant.
This is from the audience, and it kind of dovetails back on an earlier comment you made about a class and access.
I said nobody here.
No, about access. The question is, how does a blue-collar working-class American achieve a just, fair, equitable, and sustainable resolution to a civil dispute without being able to afford attorneys in the justice system that seems to only be open to the poor and the very rich?
Okay, and it's not always open to the poor either, and it's a really serious problem. So, what has been happening is that there are a couple of different things that are happening around the country, and I'm really proud of a lot of the young lawyers who are developing. You know, they've created these incubators. And they figure out a way how they can still make a living and still provide services to people who are not wealthy. And wealthy is, you know, there are a lot of people, for example, I say that I really can't afford myself if I needed me for a lawyer. But there's such a huge gap between the people who are really, really poor and people who can really, really afford a lawyer. So, fortunately, some law schools are creating incubators so that they can have law firms and other entities that will be able to service people who can't afford a lawyer and who cannot go to legal services. They're also people using a lot of technology to do this. So, for example, some law schools have set up facilities, especially people who live in areas that can't get to lawyers. Not only can they not afford them, but they can't get to the lawyers. So they're setting up video conferencing where you can, and obviously since you don't have to come to a lawyer's office, a lawyer doesn't have a lot of overhead, then they can charge a lot less for the services that they provide. But people are really thinking of innovative and creative ways. Also, in some states, they have what's called a limited license. So the certificates that some states are given, the state of Washington is one, where people can get a certificate and handle certain types of cases under the supervision of a lawyer so that they can charge fees that are a lot less and a lot more affordable.
Great. Another question mm-hmm. from the audience is, well, that I'll wait for that one. what can you, this is more, because you do have a lot of, in the read-up, I mm-hmm. saw that you mentor a lot of young people, a lot of yes. young lawyers. You seem to be very accessible as a senior partner. You give total access. You give your Rolodex to some young people.
Right.
So this question, I think, is from a younger person or not. But it says, what advice can you give to a person, I should just be clear, just to a person currently studying for the LSAT or the bar exam? What advice would you give to a person currently studying for the LSAT or the bar exam?
Okay, so they're two very different things. With regard to the law school admissions test, the test is very different than when I took it, first of all. And I would try, I didn't know that there were prep courses. And for a long time, I said there were no prep courses that were available when I took the LSAT. I have since learned in the last couple of years that, yes, there were. I just didn't know about prep courses for the LSAT. And they're very, very expensive. Mm-hmm. But I have also learned that there are scholarships available for prep courses for the LSAT. There are also organizations that will help you to prepare, like there's a Council on Legal Education Opportunities that help students in college and so forth prep for the LSAT, which is free. And there are a lot of other free resources that are available. There are some law schools that have formed consortiums that help you to prepare for law school. With regard to the bar exam, one of the best things that I did in addition to annoying everybody around me is that I did take a prep course with that, and I found that it's really good to be in some sort of study group because you don't really know how much you know without bouncing it off of somebody else and getting someone else's perspective. Same thing that it's diversity is the same thing. It's diversity of thought that you obtain. And also it's very helpful to read old bar exams, practice with old bar exams, and talk to people who have taken the bar exam. There are also a number of different bar associations that offer prep courses and additional studying tools for people who are taking the bar exam.
These are all audience questions.
Yes.
I've thrown mine away. These are some good questions.
Right.
But they're all over the place, so you got to float like a butterfly, sting like a bee in honor of Muhammad Ali.
Uh-huh.
Can law catch up to technology? Can law catch up to technology, or has the law sufficiently caught up to technology?
No to the second question, mm-hmm. in my opinion. And one of the reasons is that, surprise, surprise, lawyers are resistant to change. And so a lot of times people really are, they don't want to do anything new. I think that it is critical, though, if you want to stay engaged and to keep up, that you have to be engaged in technology. There are some law firms now that have, there is some, you all familiar with Ross? Ross is the robot for lawyers, that at least one law firm has gotten a Ross that will do certain types of work. I don't know whether Ross needs malpractice insurance, but it's something that people are really starting to think about. I don't think that technology will ever completely replace lawyers, but it will make things different. But and lawyers need to catch up.
Mm-hmm. This is somewhat related. It said, very recently, while serving jury duty, both the prosecutor and judge lauded and praised how lucky we are to have this system with this attitude, can there be change? It's sort of a dovetail to the idea that lawyers don't like to change.
Right.
The person is saying, with the judges and prosecutors so confident that this is the best of all possible worlds, can there be change?
What do you mean with the best of all possible?
I assume this is the best system in the world. So therefore, why I complain about it? It's not broke. Don't fix it.
Oh, it is broken. But from my experience of visiting other countries in the world, I will say even with its flaws, I think it is kind of the best system. But there still is so much work that needs to be done.
I think Thurgood Marshall said it was the best system in the world. And the second to it, I think, was Kenya's, the Constitution, because he helped write Kenya's Constitution, Thurgood Marshall. Yeah. So he wanted to get that in. What are the major Supreme Court decisions that are at risk of being overturned if an anti-progressive president is elected and nominates anti-progressive Supreme Court justices? That could be either of the two candidates. So I was going to make a joke, but actually it applies to both candidates. What are major Supreme Court decisions are on your purview in terms of what might be at stake?
I think that there would be another Fisher case. Obviously, abortion would be one. Mm-hmm. I think that probably the voter law that mm-hmm. was just ruled to be unconstitutional in North Carolina would come before the Supreme Court to be revisited. And that those three things will be very disruptive. But I think that anything relating to, I think that somehow people would figure out a way to bring back same-sex marriage. I think that health care would be an issue. A number of rulings, I think, could be upended.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of police officer-related questions back to back. One is, can and will the legal establishment make a law to have police wear body cameras and make videos available to lawyers for defendants?
So, laws like that are local. Even the Justice Department, for example, cannot mandate what a local police department will do. The body cameras are very interesting because even though some of them have, we found that they're turning them off. Depending on the jurisdiction, some information is not obtainable through the Freedom of Information Act or other mechanisms. So it really depends on the particular jurisdiction. But I think more than lawyers, I think the public, because it goes back to voting and what it is you want. I think the public plays a big role in determining what happens in a particular jurisdiction. I think that Cook County, where Chicago is located, is a real good example. People were very upset with the prosecutor over the shooting. Mm-hmm. They voted her out and voted someone else
in. Cleveland, too, with the Tamir Rice case.
Right. And so I think that, the public plays a really major role in what happens in local jurisdictions.
Okay. This is a law student question. Given the prohibitive expensive costs of attending law school and relatively poor job prospects, how can we get underrepresented people in the legal profession?
Okay, so first of all, that there are jobs in some locations. You just have to want to live somewhere else. I have been to places in the United States where there have been billboards say that they're looking for lawyers. And there are places that have loan forgiveness for lawyers who will work in public service in rural areas for a period of time. So it depends if you want to stay in San Francisco, if you want to stay in New York, if you want to stay in D.C. or someplace like that. Jobs in large law firms that pay young lawyers at $180,000 a year, which will pay your student debt, they are few and far between. And really the truth of the matter is that these large law firms have never been the major employers of law students. Law school graduates are having better opportunities, but some young lawyers are still required to hang out their own shingle. And if they do, then we've got toolkits available that we've developed for them that free on the ABA website. But, you know, I think that, you know, what I tell young people is that if you are not wed, that you should really think about other opportunities outside of the big cities and develop an expertise in someplace. Because if you've lived through 3 years of law school, you can live two more years someplace else to develop an expertise and then maybe transfer it to someplace else. The other thing is that you don't have to be restricted to working in the United States. You know, we live in a really global society. Everything is connected almost. And so there are opportunities. I think we have to just be a little more creative in our thinking. But law school, that is not to downplay how much law school costs, which is really unbelievable to me, the cost of law school.
Can I just say one more thing? Please do.
Long term, over the course of your career, you will still make it back, and it is worth the while.
Nice. Mm-hmm. These are related questions, so I'll ask them both back to back. Are there serious and powerful voices within the Bar Association to take a more active and effective, unconventional role in addressing injustice? If yes, how to access those unconventional means? And then the second question is, what is the role of the legal community in dismantling institutionalized racism in our justice system? So they're both asking, you know, institutional justice question.
Okay, so one of the things that, you know, I think that most of us understand that there's a lot of bias in the justice system, and a lot of it is implicit or unconscious bias. You know, people will, you know, say that they are very well intended, but, you know, as I explained to people, good intentions are most of the time not enough. And so one of the things that we've done this year is we've created tools for judges, prosecutors, and public defenders. We've created some implicit bias videos where on the judges video, for example, we have three judges to talk about their own biases, to acknowledge that they have them, and to say how they have affected their decisions in the past, and, you know, talk about taking the implicit association test. And we also have experts on the videos to talk about implicit bias and how to stop yourself from responding to your bias. And then in addition to the videos, we also will have training materials, written materials, and a PowerPoint, so that people can, after they look at the video, have something to refer to give them some tools to work through their biases. We are also creating model rules so that juries can be instructed about implicit bias. So, and all of these things are free and available on the
This is
website.
A perfect follow-up. Mm-hmm. How would you define this concept of implicit bias, and how does one determine theirs once identified, and how do you navigate your biases once you know you have these? So how would you define it? How does one identify theirs, and then how does one navigate it once they know they have it?
Okay. So implicit or unconscious bias is something that's innate kind of in all of us. It may be a different kind of bias depending on who you are, but it's something that you don't have a lot of control over. It's something that your brain reacts to without you really knowing it, based on something that has happened in the past, the way that you were raised, particular culture that you might come from. And so it causes you to respond to things in a way that you don't necessarily have control over if you're really not thinking about it. So, you know, one of the things that happens a lot of times is that, you know, you have a reaction to people who you don't even know. And so you have a certain reaction to them because of some unconscious bias that you have because of something that has happened to you or something that you saw on the news. So one way of finding out what your biases may be is there's something called an implicit association test. So it's implicit.harvard.edu, and there are a number of tests that you can take that will let you know whether you're biased on the basis of age, on the basis of gender, on the basis of skin tone, on the basis of race, and you know, so that you can maybe not be biased. So we have a prosecutor who's Native American who found that he was biased in favor of lighter-skinned Native Americans, that he treated or wanted to prosecute darker-skinned Native Americans more than the lighter-skinned ones. So these tests will tell you or give you an idea about what your biases may be. And as one judge said on the tape, he said because he was raised by an African-American woman, his mother died young, and he had handled civil rights cases before he became a judge, he was shocked when he took the IAT test and found that he was biased against African-Americans. So the first thought in his mind was that the test was invalid. And so he did a lot of research and a lot of studies and found out that the test was absolutely invalid. And sometimes stress causes us when we're in a hurry. You know, that's when implicit biases really come out. And then sometimes people feel like because they know something so much that, you know, it's so funny because they say it's you have a gut feeling about something and they say your gut is contaminated. And so you really, you know, you really have to really think about and really dial back while you're having a certain reaction to certain things, especially if you don't know anything about the person. It's just because of who they are or what you may have heard about them. And there are constant things that are or constantly people are telling us, you know, like when Katrina happened in New Orleans, for example, and you saw the pictures taken by the same people that showed African Americans with bags they were looting. But when you saw pictures of white people with bags, they were finding food for their families. And so when this message is given over and over and over again, then people start to think that that is true about a particular group of people. The same thing, you know, I looked at, there's a they finally took it off. They must have heard me talk about it a lot. But there was a sleep commercial, and there was a new drug for it, and there was a little squiggly thing that caused the lady to get to sleep, and it was white. And the thing that caused her not to get to sleep was black. And so you still get these subliminal messages over and over and over again telling you what's good and what's bad.
This might seem like a tangent, but when Mr. Khan responded to Donald Trump and called him a black soul yesterday, I was like, well, I have a black soul and I love it.
Right.
So I was like, damn, maybe he should say a dark soul.
Right.
Because he doesn't understand that actually offends me and I'm on his side.
Right. Right.
Because he said it repeatedly, a black soul, he's a, you know, I'm like, wait, there's black people in America and we like black.
Right. And yes, that's like dark comedy. You know, everything. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is a follow up and related to this point. And it asks the question of, to what degree do you think the recent emphasis on discussing implicit bias in our system has involved a sort of turning away from emphasizing the structural biases? So the structural versus the implicit.
So implicit can be very structural and very systemic, and it happens every day. So it is a function of structure too. So I think the question really is blatant racism versus implicit bias is the question. And so that there is what seems to me some still racism that definitely exists when people still put things in code words and know that they're doing it. And so, you know, that obviously has to be addressed too. But we think that if you take certain steps with regard to implicit bias, which is more widespread, I think, than the overt bias, then if we can make some real systemic changes in that regard, that it will be helpful.
Thank you. This is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we are talking to Paulette Brown, the president of the American Bar Association. I'm James Taylor, your moderator. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see program videos on your YouTube channel. The next question is that Brian Stevenson gave a TED Talk in which he states that, quote, we have a system of justice in this country that treats you much better if you are rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent. Wealth, not culpability, shapes outcomes, is what Mr. Stevenson said. In light of this reality, is it really possible to create a system where justice is blind and based on the issue of class, race, and sex? I'm missing a word here, but to clarify, is it possible to have a system that is sex, race, and class blind?
So my question is do you really want it to be blind? because sometimes when things are colorblind and so forth, you know, my thing is that when people talk about things being colorblind, I don't know if I like that, because if you're colorblind.
And that's my question. That's right. My word, not the question. That
okay.
Would be fair to that person.
Okay.
But that's my word.
Because when I think of colorblind, you see everything is white.
Yeah.
So I'm not really in favor of that, but Bryan Stevenson is one of my heroes. So he is right with regard to, you know, if you have a lot of money, you have the resources to get the best lawyers to do the best investigations and, you know, do all the things that are necessary to provide the very best defense for you, whereas people who don't have money don't have those opportunities. And it sometimes it results in innocent people going to jail. Yeah. And it also results in what's now a debtor's prison, which is supposed to be against the law. You have, for example, a woman, African-American woman, who was killed outside of Baltimore yesterday by the police. The police said they were going on a warrant. She had a warrant as a result of a traffic violation.
Yes, sir.
A traffic violation, and the police knocked in her door because she didn't answer the door, and they said she had a shotgun, but there's no video or anything because they were inside of the apartment.
They went and got a key from the landlord without a warrant, and went into the house.
She was holding a 5-year-old child when they killed her, and they shot the child too.
And she had a shotgun, and I assume she had a right to have it.
They said,
right, of course,
exactly.
Of course.
They said, but we don't know.
Yeah.
But they were inside physically her apartment, and killed her. And so, I would venture to say they would not have done that to a lot of people.
Well, this is related to the last question. It says, does the high cost of engaging in lawsuits and hiring lawyers stack the deck against poor people and minorities? If so, what needs to be done to fix this? The stacking the deck. You are the president of the ABA.
Oh, yeah, right. So I know all the answers to everything. I'm the genie that comes out of the bottle.
They believe you can answer. Yes.
I'm the whiz. So I think that, you know, one of the things, you know, that I'm really happy about is that, you know, lawyers provide a lot of pro bono services more than any other profession.
Mm-hmm.
And that they continue to do that, and they're doing more and more of it. And there are so many lawyers who volunteer to take pro bono cases for people who are on death row, for the wrongly accused. There are a lot of innocence projects that lawyers are volunteering for. There have been a number of lawyers who have volunteered, including through the ABA, for the Clemency Project to help to get, you know, people out of jail. But as many lawyers as there are, there's still not enough to go around. We fight for more funding for legal services, $475 million, and still so many people are not served. You know, wealth and poverty and the gap between the two is just a really, really huge issue in this country.
It says, this next question is related. It says, what do you think of the current system of providing public defenders? Are you satisfied with the current system?
No, I'm not satisfied. And in fact, I wrote a letter to the governor of Louisiana, because actually what some states are actually asking public defenders to do is really violate the rules of professional responsibility by asking them to take on enormous caseloads when they know that they cannot legitimately handle all of the cases that they have. And so what ends up happening, not at the fault of the public defender, but people have ineffective counsel because the caseload is just too much and they don't want to fund them properly. And in so many cases, I remember when I got out of law school, prosecutors always made more money than public defenders. They always had more resources. So the deck was always stacked against the person who couldn't afford a lawyer and the public defender.
You have a lot of interesting questions coming at you. Here's another one. Can a lawyer decide to represent a class of people like Trump versus Trump University students without being a part of that class? Can a lawyer decide to represent a class of people without being a part of that class?
I don't understand. So generally, if there's a lawsuit and there's a class of people, the lawyer would not be a part of that class. They can't do both.
Mm-hmm. I'm a law student and personally would like to be a public interest lawyer, but mostly like likely I have to go into private sector. Many young lawyers who are passionate about promoting social justice are being turned away because of the shortness of public interest jobs. What has ABA done in this area of trying to encourage more public interest lawyers?
Well, I don't think that there's any shortage of people who are interested in public interest work. And the other thing is if you get a regular work, there's nothing preventing you from providing pro bono service, which is public interest work as well. So, you know, there are always opportunities to do public interest work. And the Young Lawyers Division of the ABA, they have all sorts of information available on their website and all sorts of programs that are available to other young lawyers. But there's never any shortage of opportunities to do, even if you have to get a job in the private sector, that does not preclude you from doing public interest work. And if you go to a firm, you can check the firm to see how much they value pro bono work.
These are some other related questions. This one is, what is one of the most important things we can do every day to make the system more just? What is the most important lessons to teach our children to make the system more just?
I think that because a lot of the biases are learned that people have, I think that that we can explain to our children the different conditions in the world and to expose them at a very early age so that they won't be afraid of different types of people. Expose them and put them in situations with other people, with poor people, with people who don't look like them, and have them to understand that they're no different than they are. One of the best things that I was taught by my parents is that no one is better than I am, and I am no better than mm-hmm. anyone else. Mm-hmm. And so that has really stuck with me all of my life. And I think that is something that we really need to teach our children. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. As long as millions of dollars can be made from locking people up, there will always be millions of reasons to do so outside of the purview of justice. Prison privatization, asset forfeiture, prison labor, etc. How can we secure justice in the justice system when our current system lends itself to a corrupt market profiteering from poverty and pain, like we saw, this is me adding, ad-libbing, like we saw in Ferguson, where every household, I think, had three warrants in each family.
So there are a number of things that are in play with regard to that. I think that there has to be bail reform. One of the things that I learned as president of the ABA is that bail bondsmen are the biggest lobbyists in state legislatures, which was such a surprise to me. But, you know, it is in their best interest, you know, to keep that cycle going. I think that there has to be very serious bail reform. I think that there have to be payment plans, especially for civil actions, because so many people who are in jail are there as a result of some civil penalty that happened that has now become criminal. So you have a traffic violation, you can't pay it, so then you be in contempt of court. So contempt is criminal. Mm-hmm. And so when you can't pay if you couldn't pay the first fine, so you've had people who have spent serious time in jail as a result of even a parking ticket that they couldn't pay. So I think that we really have to look at a lot of alternatives, and some courts are really developing a lot of alternatives now, because now, even with all the money that's been made, it is now so costly that even that can't be sustained at this point. So that's why you have a variety of different people looking at mass incarceration at this point, because it just can't be sustained mm-hmm. anymore. Mm-hmm. And I have to say that so many of us are guilty for it getting to the way it is. And none of us, there's enough guilt to go around, because everybody wanted law and order. Nobody wanted the crime in their neighborhood. We didn't want the drugs in our neighborhood. Yeah. We were concerned about people taking crack. And so we wanted tougher drug laws and so forth. Yeah. So nobody is exempt.
A lot of people aren't forgiving Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton for this when the Congressional Black Caucus And many black mayors signed on
exactly
to these,
laws. That's
right. And now all of a sudden everybody's forgotten that.
Right.
A question about
they haven't forgotten it.
This is an ABA question. What is the American Bar Association actually doing to address diversity and inclusion as well as implicit bias in the legal profession?
Okay, so some of it I've answered already, but one of the things I did was is that I created a Diversity 360 Commission, which looked completely at diversity and inclusion, because I don't know whether you all know it, but the legal profession is the least diverse profession of all comparable professions. 88% of all lawyers are white. And we're least diverse than accountants, engineers, surgeons, architects. Pretty amazing. And so, and when you think about the number of women who are in the profession, and the number of people of color who are now in profession. So, for example, in law firms, women of color represent 2.5% partners. African American women, less than 2% of partners. And so we wanted to create some systemic changes. So there were four working groups. And we also believe that you can't wait until a person's in law school. You can't wait until they're in college. We want to start with kindergarten because people are not making it through 12th grade because you've got this school-to-prison pipeline. So we want to find ways to disrupt that. And so we've created all these resources and a data bank. We found that there's so many different resources that we didn't want to create any. So we identified what they are and ones that can be used elsewhere. And so we looked at kindergarten through 12th grade, 12th, college, and then law school to bar passage to improve the pipeline to the legal profession. And for my small part, I have been visiting Boys and Girls Clubs. So today I went to my 40th Boys and Girls Club since I've been president. And so just to let people know, because I did not know a single lawyer until I was in college, just to have them understand that there are windows of opportunity available to them. So we had a pipeline group, and then we had sort of an internal group to the ABA. So we wanted to look at all of the policies that existed in the ABA, because we didn't want to go out telling people, other people, what it is that they should be doing without making sure our house is in order. So we've created guidelines for all of our entities on diversity and inclusion. And recently, in June, we created a policy that any entity within the American Bar Association that sponsors or co-sponsors a CLE, a continuing legal education program, that that if they have at least four people on the panel, including the moderator, there must be diversity on the panel. We also, one of the things that holds a lot of people back from doing better in their firms is economics. And so we had an economic working group that we're asking through a resolution to develop policy that people who spend money on lawyers spend a greater percentage of their money on more diverse people to give them some more economic power. And then we are creating a database and keeping track of who's doing that. So we've created, and we've got a foundation that's interested in helping us to create information. One big good piece of news is that we've created a diversity and inclusion web portal. You know, all the information is free with all sorts of tools that people can use. And I just got word, I had asked them back in February, and I just got word last week that Microsoft has agreed to create an app for diversity and inclusion using all of the information that we've contained, so anybody can download the app, get any information on diversity and inclusion within the legal profession. And then the fourth working group is there's the pipeline, implicit bias, economic and internal. So, and then on the implicit bias, I told you what we were doing. And one of the other things we did on the pipeline is that the military is one of the most diverse organizations. So we felt that that was a way to help build the pipeline. And so we did a video. I interviewed the vice admiral for the Navy, who's in charge of all the lawyers, to help promote and recruit more people to become lawyers and, you know, help the JAG Corps too.
And so that was a question I was going to follow up with. It's your model of commission, the Commission on Diversity and Inclusion. It's transportable.
Yes, it is very transportable. Yes.
The next question from the audience is, if you could change three things about sentencing and the prison system, what would you change?
So you got to dial it back before you get to the sentencing. You got to dial it back to the prosecutors. You got to dial it back because when you get to a lot of sentencing, if a person is found guilty, the judge does not have as much discretion as we'd like to think they have. So a lot of sentence, because there's so many sentencing guidelines that mandate what judges have to sentence. There's a lot, some discretion, and judges have to be real mindful of how they sentence people to make sure they're not discriminating against one group of people. But the issue really starts with the prosecutor, who makes the determination whether a person will be charged and what they will be charged with. So you've got to make sure that prosecutors really understand their biases and what it is that they're doing when they decide that they're going to charge somebody or say this is just an aberration, we're going to let this person go. It happens so much, especially in a juvenile justice system, because assumptions are made about certain groups of people. They're probably from a single family home. We can't send this child back home because it's just a broken home anyway. And so they will detain them, as opposed to maybe another child who is wealthy or is white. They will call their parents and assume that they have parents to go home to. So it really starts at the prosecutor level, as opposed to you got to do something before you get to the judge.
Mm-hmm. Michelle Alexander outlines the power of prosecutors in criminal justice cases. Does this need to be changed in terms of the balance of power that sort of shifted to prosecution in the last 20 years or so?
I think the prosecutors have had a lot of power for a really long time. And they are the frontline people who make the most key decisions. And I don't know that that's really going to change the power that they have. I think there has to be a recognition of the power that they have, and they have to have better training. Really pleased that the Justice Department has decided to train all of their personnel in implicit bias. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. This is a San Francisco question. It says, San Francisco is a sanctuary city where undocumented felons can live regardless of how many times they have been deported of their crimes. If Kate's law, after Kate Steinle, who was killed here, is passed, what impact will that have on the legal system? Is it workable? Whoa. I'll leave it there. There are two other questions here. The second one is, how can justice ever be served when attorneys can charge so much and take so long to adjudicate cases? Do you see us moving, do you expect us to move toward more drug courts for those addicts in the system? So these are three very different.
Yeah, they're three real questions.
So let's stick with the sanctuary city.
I can't answer that question because I don't know enough about that particular law that's localized.
How about this one? How can justice be served when attorneys can charge so much and delay the process of adjudicating a case?
So, always attorneys don't delay the adjudication. There's so many backlogs in the court system because so many lawsuits are filed. You know, there's something that's called alternative dispute resolution that people are engaging in more and more, which I think is a good way to move faster through the justice system. But, you know, you've got a lot of different issues in play. You've got some states that have no regard for judges. The legislature, though, does not. And so they won't properly fund the court. So there's a lack of judges. There's a lack of administrative people. And so you have those kinds of issues. And then, you know, lawyers will charge what people will pay. Just because a lawyer charges, people sometimes believe that the more you have to pay for a lawyer, the better the lawyer is, which is not necessarily
like a
the
bottle
case.
Of wine, right?
Well, you know, it depends on what your taste buds are used to. But that is not always the case. So you know, people, you know, a person does not have to go to the highest priced lawyer that there is to get good service.
Thank you. This is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we are talking to Paulette Brown, the president of the American Bar Association. I'm James Taylor, your moderator. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see program videos on your YouTube channel. The next question follows up to your discussion about bail reform. It says, you spoke about bail reform briefly. Can you talk more about existing initiatives, particularly the use of risk assessments, pretrial, and the equity racial concerns associated with them?
So bail is always supposed to be risk assessment. That's what bail is, to ensure your return to court on the designated day. So so people have gotten away from that. So part of bail reform is looking at, I think, the nature of the offense and the probability that somebody will return on their designated court day. And some things don't really require bail at all. So you have and so many people are in prison because they have not made bail. And you look at one of the more horrible examples, like the 16-year-old in New York.
Right? Yeah.
You know, such a minor offense that he said he didn't do, but he couldn't make bail. And it was a really minor offense. He was in prison for so long and an adult prison. And they say that a person, even if they spend one night in prison, is, if they're not guilty, is more likely to actually commit an offense than somebody who's never spent a night in prison. So I think that bail reform and the way it's structured and what they require people to do, and a lot of it, again, depends on what the perception of someone is, whether they let them go, whether they will, you know, understand whether they will return, is a real serious issue. And what kind of crimes, you know, whether they are crimes against other people, crimes that really hurt somebody, to determine what bail should be. You know, I thought about, and let me just say this one other thing. I thought about, you know, the Freddie Gray case, for example, and the low bails that were set for the police officers. And then the young man who turned himself in for throwing things at the police car, his bail was 20 times the amount, and nobody died.
From your perspective, does anybody care? I mean, in other words, when we see judges there was a ruling this past week where the court, and I know it was more complicated than the headline, but it basically suggested that police officers now have the right to rape minors based on a ruling with some particulars in a particular case. I think it was in Minnesota, somewhere in the Midwest. And it was a particular case about a cop who got involved with a minor person, got exposed, caught by the parents in the situation, and they considered it rape, and it went on and on. Say that again? And so I'm just, in other words, is it the attorney general? Is it the legislatures? Who's in charge right now in this crisis in America with the law and law enforcement?
So people are at large.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, as I mentioned before, it's so much of it is local.
Mm-hmm.
There is no national police force, if you will. The closest thing is the Justice Department, and they have limited jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
So everything is really local, mm-hmm. which is why it's really important for everyone to be full participants in their government. Mm-hmm.
Does offering pro bono legal services create a selection bias to the types of lawyers offering service? If so, how does this factor into the notion of implicit bias? Does offering pro bono legal services create a selection bias to the types of lawyers offering service? If so, how does this factor into the notion of implicit bias?
I don't know that I understand that question, but people who offer to do pro bono services do it. Nobody's exempt from having implicit bias, but there are a lot of people who do pro bono work. Sometimes people who do transactional work think that they can't do pro bono work, but everybody can do pro bono work. Mm-hmm. So,
what was your reaction to Ruth Bader Ginsburg's recent involvement in the presidential and political process? And there's another question that says John Roberts appeared alone in his robe on the cover of Fortune magazine that was and continues to predict his court's business and corporate preference. Can you comment on the court's bias or neutrality and Ruth Bader Ginsburg's role?
I cannot comment on that.
Okay. Does our justice system adequately address sexual assault? If not, what changes would you suggest that can be made to address sexual assault more adequately?
Well, you know, again, you talk about privilege. You think about some dastardly things that have happened. happened in California with the kid from Stanford, the judge thought that there was pretty much nothing wrong with that. I think that people being more vocal, especially like the sexual assaults that happen on campus and so forth. And then, you know, if you're a prize athlete, the rules are different. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so people still have biases as to who they want to prosecute. And, you know, they talk about, it's interesting, they talk about ruining the life of the person who has committed the sexual assault without considering the victim. So I think that there's a lot of education that has to occur with regard to the sexual assaults and how it is just wrong, and that you can't make exceptions for certain people.
And I think the Obama administration has done a good job in the last year or two of really coming down on universities across the country and saying, get it together. This changes the subject a little bit, but it says, what opportunities exist for bipartisan unity in pushing for criminal justice reform? Do you see potential for this with regards to civil asset forfeiture, no-knock raids, or police militarization, bipartisan unity on criminal justice reform?
On none of those issues, no. I'm sorry, I don't see it. And on sentencing reform, there's even some difficulty, although it appeared that there was some bipartisan efforts. One of the things that ABA has, what we call ABA days, where we lobby Congress on certain issues, and sentencing reform was one of the ones that we did. And so I specifically met with Mitch McConnell and asked, would he bring the he wouldn't even bring the bill to the floor. Mm-hmm. And he said he was waiting for the House to bring it to the floor, and just, you know, different various excuses. So, you know, with regard to bipartisan efforts, I'm not sure as to how or when that will happen.
Mm-hmm. In your professional opinion, do police traffic quotas have a racial undertone? You were recently stopped in your car driving in your neighborhood in a hoodie, and you got pulled over?
Yes. But once the police officer realized I was a woman, he didn't. Mm-hmm. And I actually had a violation. I didn't realize my registration had expired.
Right.
My registration had expired.
Right.
My registration had expired. I did have on a hoodie. He probably thought I was a young man. When he got to the window, he saw this senior citizen lady. And he said, you know, your registration has, he said, can I see your registration? I couldn't find it. And he said, your registration has expired. And then he said, you're pretty close to home, just going home.
Nice.
Yeah. Nice. He says, just going home.
Honestly, that has been most of my experience as a black man in America. 90% of my experiences have been like that.
Right.
The other 10% are not, the fun part.
So, but think of the guy in Minnesota who was killed. He had been stopped 52 times by the police.
Yeah. And had, I think, $6,000 worth of fines, if I'm not mistaken. And I don't think people realize just the everyday quotidian living is where these encounters often happen.
Right.
How do you hold a police officer accountable when they use force appropriately but had other options to de-escalate available? I'm trying to paraphrase the question. But there were other choices that would have been less violent in that situation. How would you hold an officer accountable for escalating when de-escalation was available?
So, you know, that still goes back to the implicit bias in how they perceive certain people. So when you take, for example, them shooting dead somebody who's laying on the ground, and how they handled that person, and how they handled the person who killed the 9 people in the in the Charleston church.
Yeah.
You know, they treated him with such dignity. Yeah.
They took him to Wendy's for a burger.
Yes, they did. So, you know, it's just that they believe that different people should be treated differently. You know, when you think about how the woman knows she shouldn't have been driving her car towards the barricade, but she had children in her car and they shot her dead. Why couldn't they just shoot out the tires in her car? So, you know, so it's to me, it's a matter of how you value certain things and certain people and what you think they're worth.
The sort of critical legal theorists and studies people, Kimberly Crenshaw and people, others, they seem to sort of approach this question of race and power from a perspective that doesn't put a lot of faith in the system itself. Is it possible for us to have a truly race, class, gender, a truly attribute neutral system that is administrable based on objective facts, as opposed to where people come from, how much money they have? In other words, we see this in more homogenous societies, Canada and European countries, where there's not a lot of diversity. But it seems to me where there is diversity, the law is often used to control the outgroups. Can we possibly have, in this society, 100 years going forward, do you imagine that the laws of the land will adjust to the new realities of the browning of America?
So you asked two different questions. Mm-hmm. You asked whether it's possible.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is possible.
Mm-hmm.
Will it happen mm-hmm. is another story. Mm-hmm. And I think that, with the browning of America, it will ultimately happen because different people will be in control, presumably.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't always happen. We see it in South
yeah.
Africa and other places
yeah.
like that. But presumably it will happen. I think it will get better. I think it will get better in some respects in the short term.
Mm-hmm.
But it's going to take really long-term systemic, because you still have certain people who are in power who will never cede power.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then there are only a few other questions that I have. Going back to Baltimore, if you don't mind me asking, you've raised a young man.
Yes.
As a single mom.
Yes.
Dijon?
Yes.
You've also worked with East Orange PD on civil rights cases.
Yes.
As a mother raising this young man who's now in his 30s, early
32.
30s, how have you balanced your knowledge as a judge with your knowledge of the law and your experiences as a woman, and then just being a mother to this young man who you adopted?
How do I balance that?
Yeah, in other words, I guess I'm trying to be delicate and say, how have you dealt with the reality of raising this black child by yourself in this country?
Oh, I have a lot of help. I have a lot of help. So, for example, when I adopted my son, he was 8 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And when, you have the christening or whatever it is in church, so the pulpit area was as long as the stage, and that's how long his godparents were lined up and down, up and down. So I have had over time a lot of help
mm-hmm.
and a lot of people who I've called on.
Mm-hmm.
His pediatrician is his godfather. I could not have done it by myself, not hardly, not ever. And I've also got a really great support system in my family
mm-hmm.
so that I had a 9-month trial once, and my sisters and my mother took turns coming to New Jersey to stay with him, to take him to school and to do all those things.
Great.
So, yeah.
Great.
So,
we have now come down to the last 3 minutes of our time together. I'm going to try to get these last three questions in there, so the three people out there who are staring at me like, "Will you get my question in?" won't be mad at me. This one says, the feds have a high percentage of successful verdicts. Is their strategy to pile on charges and offer a deal, or run the risk of trial and stiffer sentencing in terms of the pleading process?
So I went to a dinner with John Legend, and prosecutors said it that statement that they get rewarded for the cases. The more cases they prosecute, the more likely they're going to be promoted. They also said when they really offer pleas like that, it's likely that they don't have a strong case.
Mm-hmm.
So there is some correlation
I know that Michelle Alexander is now starting to advocate the idea that you could really, in terms of the earlier questions about reform, what can
right.
be done. She said you can bring the system to a halt overnight, almost Saul Alinsky style, if you simply encourage clients to take the pleas. I mean, not to take the pleas. And force the trials.
Yeah.
That it would bring the system to a halt overnight.
It may not bring the system to a halt overnight, but if people... but prosecutors can inject such fear in people. And when you think about how judges, especially in the federal system, don't have a lot of discretion in the sentencing once a person is charged with something and if they're found guilty. And then, there's an issue of overcharging. And so if you overcharge, a jury may think there's so many charges, they must be guilty of something.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Last question of the evening. It's a law student, which is perfect. It says LSAT performance is strongly correlated, well, I'm assuming, with income. Given this fact, is it fair for law schools to place so much weight on LSAT scores in admission?
So I can't say what's really fair because there are standards. but I think that it is the reason why people who have money do better is because they can afford the prep courses that are available. But there are free opportunities that are available. There are scholarships. And I think that sometimes you just have to look and dig a little deeper, but there are other opportunities that can prepare you to take the LSATs.
Thank you so much. And here's my last question for the night.
Yes.
Are you thinking about writing a book, a memoir of your life and your track, your experience?
So people have encouraged me to do that. I'm not sure at this point. Mm-hmm. You think I should?
I think you should. You have an amazing story. An amazing story. Yes. 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 Let's thank Paulette Brown, the president of the American Bar Association. I'm James Taylor, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is over, and the place where you're in the know is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's what they tell you to do. Thank you so much.